And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Kirk W. from San Diego.
Aloha, everybody. I'm Kirk. I'm an alcoholic. It's really good to be here. I always forget a bunch of things. So, Sally, thank you, Sally. Thank you again, Sally. Woo-hoo! Thank you, Larry, for having me. And thank you, my family and friends, for coming. My sobriety day is June 5th, 1992. I did not plan on that when I got here. My home group is Mount Soledad Men's. My sponsor is Bill M. His sponsor goes to that home group, and his sponsor goes to that home group. I sponsor guys that go to that home group. Let's see. And this is the important thing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got here, I hated Alcoholics Anonymous. My phone number is 619-944-0914. I'll give it to you again. Any men in here, if I can ever be of any help to you, please, please, don't hesitate to call anytime. If there's anything I can ever do for you, please let me know. Aloha, Brother Jeff. I qualify. I have a picture. I qualify. There you go. I belong. I earn my seat. In fact, we'll keep their seats in the front if anyone wants to come. We've got them. But I have earned my seat. Here, we'll pass it around. Thank you very much. Let's see. So, I was at a meeting this morning, and a friend of mine who used to go to my home group, who lives up in North County now, he had two twin baby girls 3 months old. And they were like, everything was magical, like Santa Claus in Disneyland, and their little spirits were perfectly whole. They weren't damaged at all. They don't know anything about fear or doubt or guilt or shame. And they're not like judging everybody and judging themselves. And I know when I was a little baby, I was the same way. My spirit was whole and it was perfect. And something happened in my household. My dad came from like the James Dean era. And he ruled our house by like fear, intimidation, anger, and violence, you know. And by time I was 8 years old, and by time I was 8 years old, my mom, I was the youngest of four, and my mom had my schedule so busy, you know, it was like both her and my dad worked, so I played football in the fall, basketball in the winter, and baseball in the spring, and that's babysitting. And then I was in choir, I was on a debate team, I was in, I did plays, I played the violin. My mom had me busy all the time. And I hear people from the podium talk about like, I didn't fit in. I fit in. It didn't matter what you guys were doing. I was in. It didn't matter. Anything, you name it, I'd go do it. And I didn't even care about being the best or being good. I just loved hanging out with you guys. And, you know, where I didn't fit in, pardon me, I know I'll need this, where I did not fit in was in my home. Because, you know, it'd be me and my mom and my two brothers and my sister. We'd be sitting around. And you know, doing whatever, and it's like 5:30, and all of a sudden, Dad pulls up, and you freeze, and it's like, oh shit! You start checking to make sure everything's okay, because you just didn't know what would happen, and I should have prefaced saying, if my dad would have been the most loving, spiritual, and just embraced us with love, I'd still be here. So it's not his fault. But, you know, my little spirit that was whole, my dad started driving fear right into my heart. You know, and I was 8 years old. I lived in Huntington Beach, California. The kids across the street, they were like 8, 9 years old, working on cars. You heard my dad come in one night. He's yelling at my mom, and they must have seen me afraid. I was shaking or sweating because they said, drink this, smoke this, and it'll be all right. And I took the beer or the alcohol, whatever it was, and I took the joint, and I drank it, and I smoked it. And within 15 minutes, I was no longer afraid to go home and face my father. I loved the effect produced by that marijuana and alcohol. I loved it. And I literally, up till that point, I was going this way. I like had altruistic visions of being like a good person and accomplishing things. Because where I come from, you fight, you compete, you succeed, you win, you achieve, you accomplish, you give 110%. And if for some reason you're not doing the best and you fall down, you dust yourself off, you get back up, you shut the F up, and you try harder. You know. And I liked helping people. I liked all you guys. And at that point, when those kids gave me that alcohol, I didn't go this way and go directly that way. It was like this gradual curve. Because we moved down to Solana Beach when I was 11. So in that three-year span, being the youngest, does anybody remember there was a Life cereal commercial? They said, let's get Mikey, he'll try it, he'll try anything. That was me, I was Mikey. Because those older kids, they had angel dust, let's get Kirk, he'll do it, I'll smoke. I smoked the angel dust when I think I was 9 years old. I fried on acid when I was 10, I did cocaine, I drank, I smoked pot. I did other things with the older kids before I was 11. When we moved to Solana Beach at 11, it was the first time that I didn't fit in because I didn't know anybody. Both my parents worked. My mom was the assistant store manager at the JCPenney in Fashion Valley. What I didn't think about at the time, but she worked nights all the time. The assistant store manager had to work nights. So my mom worked nights all the time. My dad traveled all the time. I didn't have any friends. No parents. We've got a liquor cabinet. We belong to the country club. We've got food, a pool table, and I know where my dad hides my pot. Come on over. Instant friends, and I found the partiers. And I had been a straight-A student, and I did all this stuff. And my mom, for some reason, when we moved to Solana Beach, she didn't have my life all planned out. It was really just sports by that time. And by time I was in eighth grade, and I went to this school, Hawthorne Christian School in Fountain Valley, California, which was a really, really hard school. I mean, they were strict and disciplined and like advanced classes. And I ended up going to Earl Warren Junior High School in Solana Beach, which was really easy. I mean, it was really easy. And by time I was in eighth grade, you know, I had straight A's at Hawthorne Christian School. Eighth grade, I still have both report cards. The sixth grade report card from Hawthorne Christian, all straight A's, A pluses, excellence, incompletes, D's, C pluses, because I didn't care any longer about school. By the time I was in eighth grade, all I cared about were girls, sports, fighting, and partying. Because in Southern California, if you can ask out the pretty girl, you know what you are? You're the man. If you can play sports well, you're the man. If you can fight, and I had no problem fighting, brawling, getting my butt kicked by four guys, because even when you get beat up by four guys and you're still fighting to the very end, you're still the man. And if you can party like a rock star, you're the man. And that became my life. And I didn't know any of it at the time, you know. I thought I was just this cool partier. You know, my dad, God rest his soul, my dad passed away when he was 50 years old, but he looked a lot like I do now. And I, from about 13, I hated people that wore suits. I said, I am never, ever going to wear one of these things, ever. And I became a long hair. And I just became this partier. You know, the cool people partied. You know, that's what you did. If you didn't party the way we did, you weren't cool and we wouldn't hang out with you. You know, that was it. I thought you were lame. I had a belief system. I believed you could not have fun unless you partied. Right? I really believed you were lame if you didn't party, you know? And I believed to my core that I was going to party and smoke killer green bud every day till the day I died. I just knew that. I knew that. And, you know, really, when you look back on my story is really like, you know, you party, you hit a bottom. You just kind of like lower your standards and lower your expectations and kind of go over here where you haven't, these people don't know you yet, you know, and party and like burn all these bridges and, you know, no problem. I'll just lower my standards and go over here where these people don't know me and part, you know, and I mean, and I just burn bridges and, you know, and I went through, and I was, I mean, Sally talked about a double life, you know. I mean, I started partying young, and I had, even though I said I was going to be long hair and this, like, rebel, you know, I still had that half of me that wanted all that, like, upper middle class white to, like, accept me and think, respect me, you know. So I still did all this stuff to carry on the facade here, in the white upper middle class, you know, crap, while I'm, you know, wearing a trench coat and carrying a sawed-off shotgun and a .38 and robbing drug dealers over here, and you know, and I wound up in the restaurant industry, and you know, where you know, those four things that I like to do, they were like accepted in the restaurant industry. I mean, I was 17 years old working at the Triton in Cardiff, and you know, people would like start giving the cocktail waitresses or the bartenders or the managers a hard time. You know, three grown men, and they'd say, "Get Kirk out of the kitchen," and I'd come flying out, and I would just brawl. I mean, I'd bite, and I mean, I was just a lunatic, and you know, and they reward that behavior. They reward that behavior by buying you drinks, giving you lines, giving you joints, you know, girls go, I mean, the whole thing. And you know, but that behavior is only acceptable for a very short period of time, you know, and then burn the bridge and go some, you know, and get 86th and the police called on you by your employer. And then, you know, you go to the next place. And, you know, and the word didn't spread that fast, so I could get another job. And I'm really good out of the gate. You know, I look good coming out of the gate. I fly coming out of the gate. I work hard, and I make sure I do everything in my power to make sure each and every one of you like me. It may take one thing to make you, like me, a different thing for you, and a different thing for you, and I'll do each one of those. I'll figure out what it is each one, and I'll change 10 different times within a matter of 15 minutes. And so, you know, at 25 years old, I was a sous chef of a restaurant up in Carlsbad, and the same crap, you know. The owners thought I was this all-American guy, and you know, if you came and sat down at my oyster bar and started talking about going and buying pot from your dealer, watch out, because I'll get one of my cooks to cover my shift, and I'll follow you to your dealer's house, and I'll scope out his house for 2 weeks, and then who knows what's going to happen. So, and I'm needing to drink and do drugs. Basically, by the time I was 17 years old, I had like a 1 minute rule. Within 1 minute of waking up, I had to put something into my body. Something, you know, anything. And you know, I'd steal medicine from my father. I'd steal anything. You know, the type of person I was, we could be having a conversation, and if I just told you the truth, everything was great. But I would tell a lie when the truth would have served me better, you know. Be careful. There's about 50 to 100 to maybe 200 people out there, thank God for sponsorship because I have made amends to them, who were friends of mine, who we used to look for the people that stole whatever it is got stolen from them as I had it hidden somewhere. You know, you want to talk about a liar, a cheat, and a thief? That was me. while still trying to pull off this life. And you want to talk about the quantities of alcohol and drugs I had to put in my body just to be okay with myself. A lot. I mean, I put 24 hours a day, I had something in my body. So at 25, I was at Sous Chef up in Carlsbad, and my father passed away. And, you know, I had this, like, love-hate relationship with my father. You know, I, like, feared him. I hated him. I respected him. I loved him. All convoluted. And really, as I stand here today, I just wanted him to love me and accept me. That was it. And think well of me. You know, and he died, and I thought, remember, I'm a tough guy, that where I come from, you don't cry, you man up, and I manned up during my dad's funeral and all that, thank you, and I didn't know how much pain was deep inside of my heart over all that, and all the other stuff, because remember I told you, my spirit was like those two little three-month-old girls this morning. Well, my dad, all he had to do was hit me one time. And my head started the whole thing over again after that. And the last time my dad laid a finger on me, I was 15 years old. And between 15 and 25, when my father passed away, there was never one time, not once, that I was just walking down the street and bad stuff happened to me for no apparent reason. Never. I created all of it. And I had been in jail. I mean, I've had been on Vulcan Ave in Leucadia, spread eagle, in the middle of the street, cops with guns up to the back of my head. And nobody else did that. That was me creating that. You know, I've been shot out by people, chased in cars. I mean, but I created it all. Never once did something randomly bad happen to me. So what I know today is my dad may have started something, and my parents didn't have the spiritual tools to give me. Like, they saw me afraid and go, oh, you're afraid? Let's pray and let's meditate and let's talk to you because you're okay. They didn't do that. You know, I was alone, and then I drank and used. And then what happens to me is I think, I feel, I act, right? And usually I think bad, I feel bad, I act bad, right? And usually it's pot, booze, pot, drugs, whatever you got. And then I take actions to try and fix whatever the problem is. And my actions usually make the problems much worse than they were before. And so I went from being a sous chef at 25 to 6 months after my dad died, I was a line cook of another restaurant further away. And that's a step back in your career. 6 months after that, I'm a breakfast cook of another restaurant, back again. And I hit bottom in Encinitas. It was bad. I mean, bad. I am consuming massive amounts of alcohol, massive amounts of marijuana, crystal meth, anything you had, I would do it. And I just lowered my standards and moved to San Marcos and got a job. That's my story. And I got a job at a 24-hour dive family restaurant out in San Marcos. And my head said the people that worked there were lowlifes. And I wouldn't hang out with any of them. And I'm working the graveyard shift. And one day, this kitchen manager, bless his heart, he comes in, he calls me in his office, he says, Kirk, you're a great guy, but you really, really need to get help. I'm going to have to let you go. And he wasn't the first person that told me I needed to get help. And I was indignant, and do you know who I am? And it takes two people to replace me, and blah, 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 blah. And he said, you're right. You're a great cook when you're here. When you're not trying to sleep with my waitresses and my customers. When you're not out in the back doing drugs, when you're not leaving to go rob some guy, and when you're not trying to beat up everybody that walks through the door. And he was right. And within 30 days of that, I'm being evicted from some apartment that I wasn't even on the lease. I had just taken it over from these people that didn't live there any longer. And, you know, the police are there and my dogs. And I started living in this piece of crap 1978 Ford Courier truck. And in that picture was actually, that was January 13th of 1992 at the Metallica concert at the sports arena. I was in the drunk tank. I never saw the concert. And it was very shortly, about 2 weeks, 3 weeks after that, that I got evicted and became homeless. And remember, I'm a tough guy. And I did not last long on the street, I'll tell you. Not long on the street at all. You know, I was living in this truck and drinking. And I went in, there's a Vons on the corner of San Marcos Boulevard and Rancho Santa Fe Road. And I went in there, and you have to realize now I've got long, bushy, nasty hair, and it's not washed, and I'm wearing, you know, that I had that trench coat, and the other, and there is hanging on, and I'm bloodied, and I'm battered, and I'm missing teeth, and, you know, and I have a big, old, long, nasty beard, and I'm just a homeless guy. And I heard the manager say, "Don't do anything. Don't call the police. He won't steal as much as he'll break if we do anything." Boom, you know. So that, to me, said, "Come on back, Kirk. You can take whatever you want." And I did that. I'd go in and I'd get two bottles and a little bit. I'd usually get two bottles, just the straight vodka, and I'd get one of the big like pepperoni things to eat. And some food for my dogs, you know, that was it. And I did that. And then this girlfriend who was now living with her dealer, they would bring me like a little bit of money and like a little bit of pot and a little bit of crystal and a little bit of booze. And you know, and that was my existence. And this is the thing, you know, I thought like alcohol was my problem, but it really was the solution. Remember when I was afraid of my father, it was a solution. But I just drive solutions right into the ground, you know. And the problem with alcohol and all that drug mixture for me was that it made the unacceptable life barely palpable. You know, barely palpable. And I was truly a hope to die drunk. I mean, I would drink and drink and drink and drink and just say, "Just don't wake up. Just don't wake. Just don't wake up. Just don't wake up. Just don't wake up." And I, you know, come to the next morning furious that I was alive. And I'd be sick and I'd be puking up blood and I'd have to go straight back to that same Vons. And I'd get more because I needed alcohol to get well again. And it worked and it worked and it worked. And on June 3rd of 1992, I was in a park right down the street from the Vista Jail, which I had been in a few times. And I was drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking. And it wouldn't take the pain away. It wouldn't take it away. And I said, "Help." I said, "Help, help, help." And you know, I had had, you know, I was raised Catholic and I didn't believe in that God. And, you know, over the years of drinking, you know, I had the, you know, the "God damn it" God, you know, and I had the 911 God, "I'm getting beaten up," or "I'm getting arrested again," or, you know, "She's leaving me," or "I'm getting fired," that God, you know. I even had the 411 God, you know, like "You're real happy and you're talking about Jesus and I jump on your bandwagon because you look like you got your shit together," but I could only mount, you know, stomach that for about 30 minutes. So I had, you know, there was some God in me, but never much. But this day, June 3rd of 1992, I pleaded from the bottom of my heart for help. I wasn't saying, "God, help me." I was pleading to the friggin' universe, "Please help me." And within like 18 hours of me pleading, my mom and my brother were bringing me to a hospital, you know. And the last time I saw my mom, I had gone to her house. She opened the deadbolt, had the chain, stuck a $50 bill through the little crack, and said, "If you ever come here again, weeping, I will call the police on you," because I had spit in her face, hit her, robbed from her the time before that. You know, I'd end up calling my brother, and they told me to come over to my mom's house the next day, and they brought me to Scripps McDonald Center, and that was, and I had to drink, do the last bit of lines, and smoke a joint just to go to my mom's house, and I was all indignant when I got there, and they were waiting at the bottom of the driveway for me, because they weren't going to let me anywhere near the house, and I didn't know my brother had two friends, big guys in the house, in case I tried to do anything, and they took me to this hospital, you know, and I didn't, you know, when I got here, so there were a couple things. I love that I had a shower and a bed and warm food. Those were like the first things. But then some other things that I really liked, like you guys looked at me as a human being and you were like happy, or acted like you were happy that I was there. Because when I was on the street, people only looked at me with disgust, pity, or fear. That was it. You know, that was it. And I wasn't, you know, when I was out there on the street like that last 2.5-3 months, I wasn't look, you know, if you had your stuff together, you know, I'm not looking you in the eye. As soon as somebody that had their crap together caught my eyes, boom, you know, I felt so bad because I was full of doubt, guilt, shame, self-judgment. I mean, I walked around talking crap to myself about myself all the time. I was a piece of shit before I got here, you know. And but you guys welcomed me. And, you know, I didn't believe in this. This was FNAA, the effing big book, the effing steps, the effing meeting, the effing sponsor, the effing God. I didn't like any of it. A guy like me talking this long, the effing a-hole, you know, I didn't, you know, no thank you. And, you know, they vanned us over to that La Jolla speaker meeting, and I was sitting, I think, in that seat right where you are, that first seat right there, and they, yeah, you, right there. I was sitting right there at La Jolla speakers at a different speaker meeting. And they read the traditions, and it was the first time I heard the third tradition. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I was in there like 9 days, and they took us to this meeting. And I'm like, what? I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I got up. I start going back. I'm leaving. And the guy who drove the van, Bob Palmer, who became my first sponsor, he's sitting in the back. He's like, where are you going, Mr. Happy? I go, I just heard that. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I'm out of here. I was going to walk back to McDonald Center, pack my bags, and leave. And he goes, well, if you're going to leave, let me get you a cup of coffee. You know, and we get a cup of coffee, and you know, I tell him all my story. You know, in that, like, you know, 9 minutes, I think I said like 48,000 words in 9 minutes. And he goes, I can understand you not having a desire to stop drinking, he said, but it sounds like your entire family, every employer you've ever had, all these girlfriends, the state of California, you know, the San Diego Sheriff's Department, San Diego PD, he starts listing, boom, boom, they all have a desire for you to stop drinking. He said, it doesn't say your desire, they have a desire. I was like, and as he said that, you know, he was absolutely right. I turned around and came back in. And, you know, I went back to that place, and I had planned on, you know, just kind of like gaining a little weight. Because I was, when I showed up, I was 147 pounds, and I'm over 200 now. And, you know, I was just, I was really a mess. And I was like delusional. I mean, I was, you know, I truly was. If you've ever seen a guy, big old bushy hair, really skinny, big old beard, clothes that don't fit him, bloody, battered, standing on a street corner just yelling, ah! That was me. I did that out in Escondido for quite a while. And, but I had planned on just kind of like getting warm and getting like everything back together and going back out. You know, that's what I thought. And I had planned on that. You know, this stuff wasn't for me. There was, you know, I did, like, at the first meetings I went to, it was really like, you know, it was only probably like 93% of the stuff you guys talked about. I was like, yeah, nah, nah, no thank you, no thank you. There was 7% I could relate to, right? But then, you know, 2 weeks in, it was probably like 60-40, right? And then like 3 weeks in, it was 40-60. And then like all of a sudden, you know, they were telling me things, if you go back where you're from, you will do what you do, you know. Because remember, I didn't know anybody that didn't party. I didn't know anybody that didn't party. And so I still had planned on leaving, and they said, you know, why don't you go? This is the way I heard it. No offense to anybody that works in treatment. In fact, thank you if you work in treatment. But this is the way I heard it. When you leave here, Kirk, you should go to sober living. Yeah, go to sober living. Oh, man, you know, no, thank you. So 5 days before, I was not going to sober living. 4 days before, all of a sudden, I was afraid to leave. I did not want to go back where I was from. I knew what I was going to get back. I knew what I was going to get. And so that guy, Bob Palmer, he vanned me. He took me to the Fellowship Center in Escondido, Pathfinders, and the Freedom Ranch. And all three of those places had my boys were hanging out in front of all of them. And I knew. The Freedom Ranch, finally, that was the place I was going to go because it was way out there. And they accepted me and I filled the paperwork. They only cared if like state disability paid. And we're driving back in the van to going back to McDonald Center. It's 2 days before I'm going to leave, and I'm going to the Freedom Ranch. And we're coming west on the 8, and all of a sudden, it was, you know, this is now the end of June, and crystal clear, you could see the ocean. And all of a sudden, I knew if I went to the Freedom Ranch, I would die. And I start crying, and I tell them, and I say, I'm a con man. I'm a bullshit artist. I need strict discipline. And boo, we're going. And all of a sudden, he goes, no problem. And this guy was cool. Anything I'd say, he'd just be like, great, cool, no problem. I got it covered. He takes a left south on 15. He gets off at El Cajon Boulevard and takes me to crash short term. And, and I was sitting. I don't even see anybody. I was sitting, you know. I was cool, so I was, you know, I was sitting like this, you know. And this guy kicks my feet and says, young man, put your ass against the chair. We sit with respect around here. We do everything with respect around here. And and I knew that was the right place for me. You know, I went back to, they let me in, filled out the paperwork. I went back to that treatment center I was in, or that where the treatment center, McDonald Center, and I told them, I'm going to crash. And they said, oh, you're doing so well. You don't need to go to crash. And that's how I knew I had made the right decision. Because look, I had already bullshitted them into thinking I was doing so well. I'm a con man. I wasn't doing well. I hadn't done anything. So I went to crash. Bob Palmer became my sponsor. We got into this book, and I know this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. We got into the NA book too, but he would constantly go, the best directions are in here, but you need to figure that out on your own. And, you know, we looked at, sure enough, on page 21, it talks about the real alcoholic. At some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts. That was me by 13. You know, real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde does absurd, incredibly tragic things while drinking. You know, that was me. You know, and then they talk about the big one. They talk about, frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. You think? So I became an alcoholic here working the steps with you. Oh, and remember, I was talking about, like, you know, that 60-40, 60% of the time I didn't like you, 40%. I didn't want to stop drinking, but you guys with time, and thank you for all that came before me and all that are here that work with other people. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Because you people had a strength about you, a strength of spirit that I had lost long ago. And that's what I wanted. I wanted your strength of spirit. I didn't want to stop drinking and using, but I wanted that strength of spirit. And you said, do the steps, you know. And I told Bob Palmer all my stuff, and he said he knew, My spirit was damaged when I got here. Damaged. And he used to say, just give yourself a shot to have a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. Give yourself a shot. He used to call it a spiritual healing. He said, your spirit's all damaged, and you need alcohol in all its forms to fix it. Thank you very much. To fix it, and it was no longer fixing it. So give yourself a shot to go through and have, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. He said, all the people I was pointing out, this was at La Mesa Men's. He and his cronies all went to La Mesa Men's. And they were lunatics like I had been, and they had all changed. They had all had this spiritual awakening. And they were like happy, productive members of society. And I never wanted to be a productive member of society, personally. So we got to step three, and it talked about God right there. The first word, God, is in step three. Thank God I didn't hear about it in the first two steps, because I may have left. And that's when I told him, I knew it's a cult. I'm out of here. I'm gone. You know, forget it. And he's like, that's cool. If you want to leave, just don't talk crap about AA that it don't work. And I was like, how in the hell did he know I was going to talk crap about AA that it don't work? You know, because I was. And he goes, because it's a 12-step program. You have to go through all 12 steps to get the effect. And he said, and you're only at step 2.5, kid, you know. And then all of a sudden, we're reading how it works. And he said, look, you already told me you think, you feel, you take action. He goes, around here, we still think, we still feel, and this book, we're just going to take the action outlined in this book, and we're going to see what the difference is. And all of a sudden, we're reading how it works, and it says, we ask his protection and care with complete abandon. He said, who was your life, whose protection and care was your life in before you got here? Mine. Mine. He goes, well, you think you want to ask his, whoever that is, protection and care with complete abandon? And I said, sure. Because right before that, he asked me, are you willing to go to any length? And he said, I'll never ask you to do anything that I haven't done over and over and over again. And most likely, I'm doing it all right now anyway. So are you willing? And I said, sure, of course, I'll do it. And then all of a sudden, I'm asking his protection and care with complete abandon. And you guys tell me this. I ask your protection and care with complete abandon. That's what I did. He goes, that does not seem like complete abandon to me. And all of a sudden, I'm sincerely going, I ask your protection and care with complete abandon. And I said it like 5 times, and all of a sudden I'm crying. And then he gets me right, and then the third step's right after that, and then he takes me to 63, and it says, when we sincerely do this BS, which is the steps, because that's what I call it. I called them the effing steps. Remember, this was the effing book and the effing steps. It says, when we sincerely do this, all sorts of remarkable things follow. And I will tell you that nothing remarkable was happening for me before I got here. Nothing. And all of a sudden, I'm sincerely saying this other prayer, praying to a God I do not believe in. And I end up going through the steps with him. I didn't do them happily. Hold on. Let's take a show of hands. Who here has, when their sponsor said you get to write your 4-step, now go, woohoo, I get to write a 4-step. Did anybody do that? 1, 2, woo, God bless you. I did not do that. I dragged my feet. I was not happy, but I just did it. And lo and behold, alcohol in all its forms got removed from my life. Got removed from my life. All of a sudden, I was doing all these things sober that I had never done sober before. I was working sober. I was playing sports sober. I was dating sober. I had never dated, done anything like that sober. I was hanging out in the middle of you guys, going to that first dance down in Mission Valley on New Year's Eve or whenever, went to that thing sober. That was the first place I ever danced sober. I was all nervous. And he said, just keep saying the serenity prayer, the serenity prayer, the serenity prayer, the serenity prayer. Would you like to dance? I just followed his instruction. Most of the time when he would give me direction, my head would say, no thank you, no way, no effing way, I'm not doing it, no way am I doing that. And out of my mouth would come, all right, And I'd go do it. He had me setting up chairs, making coffee, doing all this. My first year, I went to 1,000 meetings because I had nothing better to do. And one day he called, and I ended up staying in sober living for the whole first year. And at the end of that first year, he called me up and said, I want you to come over to my house. And I had never been to his house before. And he got me in front of this big old mirror, and he goes, you see that guy right there? I'm like going, who? There's somebody else? Who? And he goes, no, you. He goes, you've had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I was blown away. And he was right. My spirit had healed. It was like strong. Like I wasn't like lying and cheating and stealing all the time. I hadn't hit anybody. I hadn't pulled a gun. I had gotten rid of my gun. I mean, I wasn't doing any of that stuff. I was like working, and they actually I had been at a job for a while, and they actually liked me. I was dating a girl that liked me. You know, her family liked me. My family liked me. It's like, you know, on my own. You know, he had pointed out that in the book it says, lack of power, that is our dilemma. You know, on my own power, I couldn't get through challenging spiritual situations on my own. That's why I needed the alcohol and the drugs and all this stuff to get through, you know. I hear in rooms people say, God will never give you more than you can handle. Bullshit. Bullshit. God constantly gave me more than I can handle. That's why I needed to drink volumes and volumes and volumes of alcohol. But my experience here in the program is God has never, ever given me more than we can handle. Never. Because I get strength from you guys. And I get strength from this God thing I still don't understand, you know. And I'd love to tell you that since that time he called me and said, you know, you've had a spiritual awakening, that I've just been on a trajectory like this and I've just rocketed past the fourth dimension into my own dimension. That didn't happen, you know. I have put jobs in front of recovery. I have put relationships in front of recovery. And I have hit new spiritual bottoms, not nearly as painful as the past. Without ever drinking and using, and what do? I put my tail between my legs and I run back to the program and I do exactly the same as Bob taught me. You know, I moved back down to San Diego in 2001, and that's when I made Mount Soledad Men's my home group. It's been my home group for the past 16 years. You know, and life has happened. You know, you hear stay in AA and you'll feel better. Yeah, you'll feel everything better, man, everything. And you know, good shit, bad shit, it all happens all the time, all around us. You know, it happens to me, it happens to friends, it happens to loved ones. The amazing, amazing things over this past 16 years. Because this past 16 years, I've been super consistent. Like, my amazing wife is here, and we have a 13-year-old daughter, and both of them know that all of you, perfect, all of you are far, far, far more important than they are. Far more important. Because without all of you, there is no them. There is no. AA is the foundation of my life. The foundation of my life. You know, and that, this ex-girlfriend once told me, you know, at early when I was making amends, she said, you know, don't make AA your whole life, you know. And my, you know, welcome to all you new people. Welcome. Anybody in their first year, welcome. I am stoked you are here. Once again, I've got business cards here. Any of you gentlemen, I've got cards here. I will give you my number. Any of you gentlemen, if you're ever out there in your life and it is not working for you, please, please, please call me. I'll do anything I can for you. You know, you guys have taught me that. You know, when I, this book is all, it connects us to a power greater than ourselves, which will solve our problem. And it says it'll solve all of our problems. And you know, I get power from you guys, I connect with you guys, and man, this program's all about living our wildest fucking dreams, man. Live our wildest dreams. Have an amazing life. An amazing life. Because, you know, I've got this incredible life. And, you know, where I come from, I was going to be somebody. I was going to be somebody, you know. And it's like, thank God I never became anybody. Thank God, you know. I'm just this really, 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 really happy guy. All this shit happens all around me. And I just do a little bit of prayer and a little bit of meditation and a boatload of service. And my heart is full all the friggin' time. All the time, man. Life is good. Life is good. You know? And I don't need any drugs or any alcohol or anything to change the way I feel ever. I just hang out with you guys, follow you guys around. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being my friends, my brothers, my mentors, my leaders. Man, I just follow you guys around and do service, and life is incredible. What a beautiful group you are, man. Thank you so much. Aloha.